Welcome to It Could Happen Here Pod, a podcast that is today about the fact that 10 years ago it did happen. And when I say it did happen, I mean we occupied an extremely large number of places, and we did so in interesting and incredibly bizarre ways. And with me to talk about this is Garrison, as always.
I like that you used the Twitter handle for our podcast, not the actual name, but that's fine. We're gonna go for it. But hello, hi, I'm Garrison.
With me, I have my special guest, Vicky Osterweil, who is an agitator, who is a writer, who has done many, many things, probably most famously writing the book In Defense of Looting in 2020 from, is it Bold Press?
Bold Type Press.
Bold Type Press. Yeah. Very good book. People got very mad.
People got very angry. Yeah, yes. Thank you. I'm really excited to be here to talk about the anniversary of Occupy is basically, you know, when I all got this whole train rolling. So
yeah, and the other thing that is probably relevant here is that Vicky was one of the first people at Occupy, and correct me if I'm wrong about this. I found an oblique reference to this in one of the things I read. You facilitated the first meeting.
Yes. Yeah. I guess it's on the record now. Yeah. During the general New York City General Assembly, it was called in August. There was, you know, Adbusters hopefully called for a General Assembly, and you know, a bunch of us sort of went down there, and there was a tanky party there doing a General Assembly, which was just them on speakers doing their regular ranting. It hasn't changed much in 10 years. So a bunch of us just went and sat down, you know, to the side of it and started an actual General Assembly. And by happenstance, I facilitated that meeting. And it was the first and last Occupy meeting I ever facilitated.
Yeah, okay. So I want to roll back a little bit to just before the start of Occupy, because the more I think about this, the more I've just realized that 2011 was just a profoundly weird time in a lot of ways. I think people have forgotten, like, the entire American security state is at this point being terrorized by a joint anonymous LulzSec hacking campaign called AntiSec, the symbol of which is a guy in a Guy Fawkes mask wearing a monocle and a top hat. And this was just like normal. Yeah. This was the thing that everyone looked at. I was like, oh yeah, yeah, it's the AntiSec top hat, troll face guy in a monocle.
Fun fact about that, just before we forget, David Graeber, rest in peace, who was there in the early days organizing, claimed that he had heard and talked to overheard the police talking about the reason they didn't sweep the Occupy encampment the first day when we were pretty weak, frankly, or the first week, was because there were a bunch of Guy Fawkes masks and they were scared. They were scared they were going to get hacked if they were attacked. They were scared they were going to hack them and steal their, yeah. So it was a weird time indeed. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that's, you know, I think important about this time period, if we're looking back at what Occupy was, is that, so this is 3 years after the financial collapse. And, you know, so I think, in the run up to 2011, there's been a few protests. There was a big thing in Greece in 2008 that was kind of related, kind of unrelated. But I think, in my sense of, you know, I was like 13. I was like an actual baby child. But my sense of it was kind of just like, there was this like sense that everyone just kind of waiting for something to happen.
Yeah.
And it just like hadn't, and it just like kept going and kept going and kept going. And then, you know, and then Tunisia starts. Yeah. And suddenly there's, you know, there's protests in Tunisia, there's protests in Egypt, there's like people fighting tanks in the street in Bahrain. And, you know, this becomes known as the Arab Spring, and it starts to spread to a lot of places. And Vicky, I want to ask you about this, because you were in Spain when it starts, started there. I want to talk about what was going on there. And
So I wasn't there when it started. Basically, you know, and I want to shout out, like, there were a bunch of like movements, like in 2008, right after the crash, there were a bunch of protests like outside Wall Street. They were very small, but they were like, sort of, they like produced some images. And then there was, you know, in 2009, there's the Oscar Grant Rebellion in Oakland, and you have the Madison occupation earlier in 2011, where the worker unions took over the state house in Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about
that. Yeah, yeah, everyone does. It was actually really important at the time. But yes, so I think I'm glad you brought up Greece, because I think actually Greece really, that sort of anarchist rebellion in 2008, 2009, really kicked off the cycle in a certain way, but also it wasn't quite the first domino, you know, it was sort of more of a like forecast. So yeah, so Arab Spring, is huge. It's this huge, huge event. And the US media is loving it because obviously like these sort of old, you know, quote unquote, Marxist dictators are falling. And so, of course, the U.S. is like all about it, which, of course, later on, the return of the tankies will use to confuse everyone on the U.S. left and destroy all solidarity with Syria. Anyway, but that's neither here nor there. So then in that summer, you get this wave of early summer, like May and June. In fact, the 15th of May was when the movement started in Spain, and then it starts soon again in Greece. And it was similar to Occupy in that there was these people coming together in these sort of encampments in the center of the city. I don't know if people remember or know this history economically, but Spain and Greece had recently been sort of going through these like big, big booms, economic booms, just for about 5 or 6 years that turned out to be real estate bubbles funded by their entry into the EU. And 2008 just smashed that. And they were just like incredibly impoverished. I mean, like Spain was facing something like 50% youth unemployment. Greece was like similar. Spain has recovered more than Greece has in the intervening years, but it's still bad. So you had all these, it was, you know, predominantly young folks who were, had been pushed out of the economy, who'd been pushed out of their homes, whose families had lost their homes, gathering together. And it was all over both countries and it was huge. I happened to just be in Barcelona. I had been on a planned vacation with some friends, that we had planned like sort of 6 months earlier when it all popped off. And I had also just started my writing. I would say career, but that's very generous. I had started technically being paid for writing things. And they were like, oh, write about it. Like cover it while you're there. And because no one in the US was talking about what was going on in Spain, when my article popped up, like, and this is really strange, but it was like the early days of Twitter as well. 2011, like I guess Twitter started in 2009 or something. And so like, so the one of the accounts from the camp tweets out my article. So I went there the next day. I was like, I wrote that article. And then I was like embedded for a week. And I was there for like kind of the height of the popular power of the movement in Barcelona, only for a week. But I was there on the day when there was a 2.5 million person march through Barcelona. Just like still probably the biggest march I've ever been part of and probably ever will be, was like that. And so, you know, so that goes on for a few months in Greece and Barcelona. It sort of hits similar limits that Occupy would eventually hit, which is that like, you know, that if you can take the space away from people, that's the common ground. And like, you can't really have the movement without the encampment. And also all the way in which the camps sort of force a kind of internal navel gazing and people like get really obsessed with maintaining the camp rather than the struggle with the city at large. All of those contradictions sort of like came up in Spain and Greece as well. But at the time, you know, I was there for the height of it. I come back to New York. I'm like, this is going to happen in the US. Like it has to. I think a lot of folks who had been watching felt that way as well. I actually took part in this thing called Bloombergville, which was like 50 people on a sidewalk. It was for Michael Bloomberg, right? 50 people on a sidewalk. 50 people was general. That was like when we were doing really well. It was mostly 15 of us. It was like 15 of us on a sidewalk in the financial district, like getting yelled at by cops. You know, sleeping on cardboard. You know, Occupy style, but without any attention or solidarity. But because I had been in Barcelona and I still had these comrades in Barcelona, I was like, oh my God, we're doing it in New York. So we had this thing where Bloombergville, which is like 20 people, like got to talk to a general assembly in Barcelona at the height of its power, like on a like internet link, like a really early internet link, you know? So there was all this energy that was happening. And then I think really crucially, the London riots pop off, and that doesn't get talked about very much anymore. Partially because the UK left really stabbed the rioters in the back during that and repressed the memory of it largely, and have suffered ever since, in my opinion, strategically. But, you know, that was for us in the US, that was huge. It was huge watching those riots unfold. Like, you know, again, this was like early live streaming. So like we were like watching live feeds of the riots, you know, which like was not a thing that you could really do without a TV before. There was just like, there was a lot of stuff going on that felt exciting and was really important and inevitable that it would come to the US because things were so messed up over here.
I think we should talk about what a General Assembly actually is, because I think a lot of people aren't either going to have like never actually ran into what exactly is going on or have sort of forgotten in the last 10 years after they've sort of fallen out of favor.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it was never my favorite either, honestly, but it's a meeting style, designed, it actually does largely actually come from European anarchist traditions, from Spain and Greece. But as many of us know, a lot of those traditions go back further, and have crossed the water. General Assemblies, actually, there's a long history of them in indigenous communities in, Turtle Island, for example. So it's an old meeting style, in which, the Quakers, famously also sort of co-opted it from indigenous folks out here on the East Coast. It's a meeting style in which, you know, with the exception of a facilitator, which is occasionally but not always present, everyone is able to speak together. There's an agenda sometimes, but it's basically a meeting designed where everyone present in the meeting has like an equal voice, and it's not really designed generally for decision making specifically or with like really specific goals in mind often, although there will be sort of like things that are trying to get settled. But it's designed to allow, you know, a very, very multivocal approach and for everyone to sort of put in their thoughts and their ideas. And often is connected, although not necessarily, but is often connected to consensus operation where things can't get sort of decided on unless everyone sort of agrees. And in Occupy, that was the General Assembly was sort of was a bit controversial because it was just whoever showed up obviously participates in it.
Yeah.
So, you know, unlike, you know, an organizational meeting where you know, everyone knows each other and you have to have you have to be there with an invite or whatever, you know, whatever cranky wingnut wanted to show up could. And that had pluses and minuses. It was charming sometimes, but it was also very frustrating. And in New York, where I was, it was made almost impossible to function by this thing called the People's Mic. Which I think still happens sometimes. People also have a mic check, and then everyone repeats what was said. But that means that it takes four times as long to talk as normal. So when you have a wingnut, you know, like advocating for Ron Paul, and then you've got 30 people echoing him every four words, it makes discussion completely impossible. And a micro history of the People's Mic: the reason that happened was because in the first week in Zuccotti Park, whenever we got on a megaphone, police would come and arrest whoever was on the megaphone because you weren't allowed to use amplified sound in New York. And one organizer was like, oh, no, we can like use the People's Mic. We can like repeat back to each other. And this is when we there's still mostly like 30 to 40 people in the park at any one time. It's very small. That didn't feel so bad. But then when the movement really got big, the People's Mic became completely unwieldy and also was a response to a was a cowardly response to police repression, frankly, and was a way of so the People's Mic is in my opinion a reactionary form. Anyway, that is so it's been 10 years. I haven't been able to complain about this in like 8 years. Thank you so much. But anyway, so yeah, so the General Assembly is just a meeting forum that often associated with anarchist practice or radical democratic practice, in which sort of consensus is aimed for by allowing everyone to speak their mind, I would say.
Yeah, and this I think gets us back to where we opened this episode, which is Adbusters calls an event with literally no plans to like do anything. They're just like, yeah, everyone, we're occupying Wall Street, and then yeah, and you know, as you talked about at the beginning of it, you guys basically hijack the
well, sort of. I mean, Adbusters doesn't show up. Like you said, I've never met an Adbusters person, and it was funny. Like, we would do jokes about it, but I think it's also, thinking about this in preparation for this interview, it's also interesting because Adbusters and their culture jamming is kind of like one of the results of the sort of alter-globalization movement of the like late 90s and early 2000s, the summit hopping stuff, the anarchy movement of like one generation ahead of Occupy. So I think it's sort of appropriate that Adbuster is sort of like, you know, was present in this legacy in a certain way, and a lot of those organizers were as well. But yes, I'm sorry, did I just jump in before you finish?
No.
Okay. So a bunch of people, I don't actually know who, calls for an August 2nd, you know, General Assembly to talk about the call for September 17th to occupy Wall Street. And at that point, that's when the thing I was describing earlier, like, happens, where you know, we, a bunch of folks, and I really want to underline this, most of them were people who had been in Spain or Greece. David Graeber was also there. It was like a lot of old heads. There was a comrade from Japan. It was a very international crew who had like had experience in these movements over the summer, came and had this General Assembly and sort of ran it that way and broke out. We broke off working groups, and then there was meetings sort of once a week, and then working group meetings within that, and General Assemblies from August 2nd till September 17th, at which point, you know, Occupy, the date that Adbusters had called for, actually happened.
So my impression of this, and I was very small. I had very limited idea of what was going on. The way I remember in the media is that like the media was weirdly interested in it in a way that I've never seen them. I've never seen them cover another social movement that wasn't like literally burning their offices down. And it was like, right. It was like in the beginning, it was, I mean, you know, obviously the right wing media is losing their minds, but they were kind of supportive of it. And I think, I don't know, I want to see what you think about this. One of the things that happens in both Greece and in Spain is that the product of the movement of the squares is these electoral movements. And these electoral movements just fail, like, catastrophically. Like, Sarzia takes power, like they like, you know, they have a, like, their finance minister is a left communist. He is the most far left person ever, like, to hold office since like the Spanish anarchists in 1936. And they implement austerity anyways. In Spain, you get Podemos, and it's like, well, okay, you have this thing called the electoral war machine. They're gonna take over the Spanish political system, and it collapses. It just doesn't work. They've never taken power. They've never really got anywhere. They successfully evicted a bunch of squats in Catalonia, but yeah, but and I think this is my impression of it, was that I think the U.S. media thought that they could do this to Occupy. And I think they kind of, it's weird because looking, so, you know, like I come in like to this kind of stuff around 2016, 2017. And I think it's like, it weirdly worked, but it worked because they were able to recruit the anti-Occupy people.
Yeah.
And so it's like, yeah. And so they did finally get their like cadre of like pseudo left organizers that they could use to build a Democratic Party. It's just, it was like Jacobin, and then all like the whole sort of anti-Occupy group.
Yeah, so those folks were actually active during Occupy, critiquing the people who now most loudly claim the legacy of Occupy. You know, as you said, Jacobin, a lot of those sort of social democrat groups at the time, and those of us who were there remember, they hated Occupy. They would show up, but they like would critique it constantly. They would write all these articles about how it was terrible, how there were no demands, it was too disorganized. And then I think, you know, when Black Revolt got put on the table, they were like, bring back Occupy, we like that better. but I think to be as harsh as possible, but I think, like, you know, yes, there was a lot of media coverage. It didn't feel super friendly at the time. There was a lot of media coverage. Like, the media was very curious, it was very interested, but a lot of that coverage was like, why do they have no demands? Like, why are they so disorganized? Why are they so smelly? Whatever. Like, there was a lot of slander in the press, but also a lot of attention. Which, you know, it turned out was as good as you could get, but at the time didn't feel very good. Particularly, I think. Yeah. But yes, those forces were already present, in Occupy itself, you know, sort of denouncing it, for its disorganization. And then eventually claiming that it was the reason that Bernie Sanders happened, which isn't totally wrong. Also,
yeah.
Like, I want to be really clear. Like, I think we'll get into this more, but I think like, The thing that was important about Occupy, and the thing that the people who, in my opinion, like my comrades during Occupy, or people I meet who were like doing Occupy stuff, but like who I didn't know, but like now I roll with them. Most of us have the you know, the analysis of like, it was really important that we were doing politics in the street. It was really important that we were back together, that we were talking politics. And then there were really, really intense extreme limits to what Occupy could have done. And I think Oakland really pushed those, and you know, and got to those, but, And I think the folks who were like, no, Occupy was good at the time were like, Occupy is terrible. And I think that's worth noting and thinking about.
So I think, before we sort of go into talk a bit about what happened in Oakland and talk about some of their stuff. So on a day-to-day basis, like, what is Occupy actually doing? Because I think that's also been sort of lost in this whole, like, because everyone remembers, like, the slogans, and everyone remembers the fact that there was a thing. But, you know, like, there's a bunch of working groups, and they're doing things. So, like, what was that like day-to-day, and then on a sort of broader level?
Yeah, so first of all, again, I was only in New York. I spent some time at Occupy Boston as well, but, like, I don't have a sense of what other places were like, so I really can't, I mean, other than having heard from people. So I want to be very clear that I'm, like, mostly addressing that. I think the thing that was going on was that Zuccotti Park, like, the park was, like, total chaos. Part of that was because there was a drum circle that basically was going 24 hours a day there, which meant that whenever you were down there, and it was like a canyon, Zuccotti Park is surrounded by skyscrapers, so it was just this incredible cacophony all the time, which I think was cool. It really ruined a lot of finance bros, like months, you know, like orally, you know, with an A there. But I think, like, but it also was pretty intense and unpleasant sometimes. You were like, please stop. Oh, my God. Like, that's, at one point, a General Assembly, I think, decided that drums were, like, only acceptable during certain hours. Like, near the end of the movement, like, the drum circle got reproached. When, in fact, they were, like, actually the biggest agents of chaos in Zuccotti Park, it turned out, which is another important lesson. Yeah, I think so. So, you know, also, because I had been in Bloombergville, because I had been in Barcelona, I didn't invest myself very heavily in camp management stuff. So I mostly was doing work. One of the things that I think gets forgotten about is that there were snake marches basically three or four a day, every day. After the first week, when we were really small, when it got big, there were just constant marches through the city, just like always going off. Like, you would run in, you'd be on one march, you'd run into another march, like on a Saturday or Sunday when, like, people were really, like, out there. Like, It was really, like, there was a lot of mayhem. There would be big planned marches that would then be bigger. So there was, like, a lot of, like, what people now would call direct action, what I would call largely, like, sort of symbolic practice for direct action, mostly. I don't mind. I like marches. I certainly got my miles in then. Like, I don't feel like I need to do that again. But you know, so then at the camp, people were just living there. There were a lot of, like, a lot of punks, a lot of, like, you know, a lot of homeless folks, obviously. And some encampments had a higher concentration of unhoused people. In New York, because of all the media spectacle and all the money that came in, we had a lot of nonprofit grifters by the end in the encampment. Yeah. But there's also, like, a library, a free library with all these books that, like, would be donated. There was a lot of, like, you know, political agitation. There'd be people standing around the you know, the corners of the park, you know, with signs and yelling at people. And it's also important to remember that, like, Zuccotti Park in New York is tiny. It's tiny. We had originally wanted to do it on this big plaza, like Citibank Plaza. And the cops had heard about that and fenced it off. So on the 17th, So Zuccotti is this tiny little park. It's incredibly dense, and it's surrounded by, you know, like I said, by skyscrapers. It's in this really weird part of the city that no one would ever spend any time in if they didn't have to otherwise. So there's all this stuff going on, and then there are general assemblies twice a day, which, as I said, in New York were particularly unhelpful. But I think anarchists in a lot of cities who I've talked to, like, I had a comrade down in D.C., one in Denver, they sort of said that the General Assemblies either quickly, like, got shifted or became irrelevant. I think the General Assemblies were not, in the end, symbolically important, but not really a driving force of my experience. And then there would be, like I said, there'd be a lot of organizing outside of the park. There'd be a lot of, like, meetings and, you know, talks and direct actions and marches. And then there would be, you know, I guess that's kind of the extent of it, right? Is that there was, like, a lot of direct action but there was always this park where you could go and, like, run into people and, like, hook up with people, meet people, and, like, do a weird thing. And I think that was really, like, the heart of the movement was the fact that there was this place you could go meet someone and, like, link into something weird and maybe cool and maybe not. It doesn't matter. But, like, there was always something to do, kind of. And it was constant. It was, like, this sort of 24-hour, right, like, experience. And I think that was really what what separated it from other movement waves that we've had since, and was probably, I think, its greatest strength in many ways.
Yeah, I think that was the impression that I got, and part of this also was when I was in college, like, every once in a while, you just get assigned, like, some person writing about Occupy, and it was, like, most of them were just extremely cranky about the whole thing. But,
sure,
you know, one of the things I think was interesting about it is that everyone seemed to agree, at least to some extent, that part of what was going on was that it's this way to do, I don't know if identity formation's quite the right word for it, but it's this way to sort of, like, rebuild social connections and rebuild, like, social sort of bonds in a way that just had, you know, as public space becomes just the cops, and you right. know, like, there's a table in Chinatown that I, like, call the cop table, that I'm really mad about, that, like this is in Chicago Chinatown, and I would, like, go there, so in front of the library, and there's a sign on the table that says, if you loiter at this table, you will be arrested. It's like, this is a picnic table. Like, the cops are, this table is threatening that it is going to arrest you if you use it for for what you're supposed to use tables for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think, like, it was, you know, there was a lot of, at the time, a lot of people were talking about, embarrassingly, about Hart and Negri's sort of, like, multitude stuff. A much better book that was important was also David Graeber's Debt.
Yeah.
But I think, like, you know, and there was, like, a lot of, like, people saying things about, like, the agora, you know, democracy, the sort of political space of encounter. And that stuff wasn't all wrong. Like, I mean, I'm sort of being a little sarcastic with a lot of it, but, like, but I think, like there was a lot of, you know, part of how we should understand the over-discussed, under, you know, like, over-analyzed word neoliberalism that, like, has largely become meaningless. One of the things I think is valuable for understanding is a process by which capitalism responded to the long 60s by disorganizing its production process such that the long 60s could never happen again, right? So the control, the concentration of workers within production in such a way that they could be agitated by students and then, like, sort of radically unionize, wildcat, and sort of, like, almost overthrow a government, right? Like, the neoliberalism is, like, you know, it smashes the unions, yes, but it also like distributes out the act of production, right? So that that's not so easily done. And I think one of the real problems of, you know, that was facing social movement, you know, in the period, you know, the long period, like, you know, you had stuff like in the US, again, this is where I know the best, but, like, you know, you have the LA uprising, which is huge. And you have, you know, the summit hopping movement and anti-globalization, which, you know, could attack a target, but there wasn't really a sense of, like, how it felt hard to do a local struggle, beyond, like, literally, like, a revolutionary riot like LA, which, you know, you can't really precipitate. I mean, you can't really precipitate a movement either, obviously, but I think a political movement, a form of political organizing that didn't require something on the level of George Floyd, which is what the LA rebellion was, right? But that also didn't require, like, an action from capital that you were, like, striking against, right? Like the summits or whatever, again, and, like, all of these eras are very important. This is not to, like, you know, obviously, like, this is with respect for those movements. I think it felt like we were in a political wilderness. And I think that Occupy really, and the movement of the squares globally, I think, really, like, demonstrated that it was possible to practice a kind of street politics even without, you know, a shop floor where you could organize, even without, you know, a capital P party to organize within. And I think that was really important. I think it also scared a lot of people who continues to, who are committed to those politics.
Yep.
And to the 20th century workers movement, or the 19th and 20th century labor movement, which they somehow fantasize will come back if they just wish hard enough and write enough books or whatever. So I think that was powerful. I also think we can move on to legacy later. But yes, I think that was, like, I think that was very much, like, an important thing was just, like, and, you know, I graduated college in 2009. So I was like part of that millennial generation that like, you know, had gone into incredibly deep debt.
Yeah.
Like we'd have a college degree and then like the bottom fell out of the economy. There were no jobs. And like, I think there were a lot of, you know, like people who like had anticipated a middle-class life, of some kind, not that I really had at that point, but whatever, like, but a lot of people like in my economic cohort, like had, suddenly facing, you know, proletarianization. Right. And I think that was one of the strengths of the movement. I think that was that, you know, like I mentioned the statistics in Spain and Greece, like I think that was a global aspect of this kind of movement. Arab Spring too, like there was a lot of like, that was really a response to the economic crisis. Obviously those folks were already more proletarian than the people who, yeah, the young people in the squares movements. But they innovated, they created the tahrir in Arab Spring, right? Tahrir Square, most famously in Cairo. I think like those creating a meeting place where you didn't require a pre-constructed like political community in order to engage was a strength and a weakness. And I think it also, you know, as a result of the dynamics of the General Assembly, the dynamics of the sort of voluntarist nature of that, what I'm describing, it led to a lot of people who were already confident, who were already feeling good, being able to like take more power, right? Like, and I think it also was a very white movement, certainly in New York, but I think across the country, it was largely, you know, it was majority white in a way that, you know, by higher percentages than any movement that we've really been part of since, was, and that was obviously a limit, for reasons that will be obvious to everyone, including the idea that like a lot of people pushed that like the police are part of the 99%.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, so let's talk about the police, because, you know,
yes,
talk about neoliberalism,
please.
Like that's one of the other extremely important aspects of this, is this immense militarization. I mean, okay, so I think the militarization of the police as a phrase, I think, is somewhat misleading in that like the cops have always like shot people.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's still like, there's an intense sort of ramp up of the prison sector. There's, you have this intense boom in the size of prisons. You have, you have increasing parts of the economy that are just, I mean, you have entire towns that used to be sort of manufacturing sectors, used to be sort of involved in sort of industrial production, that are just like, the economy is now just, there's a prison there. And
right.
And I think this is also, looking back, one of the things that it looked like Occupy kind of ran up into, because, you know, Occupy is this attempt to, like, you know, form a democratic space. And it relies crucially on this thing that is nominally in the Constitution but doesn't exist, which is the right to freedom of speech and the right to freedom of assembly. And freedom, yeah, of assembly, like, that is bullshit. It does not exist. If you actually believe that this exists, like, try getting, like, 70 people into a space and see how, like, just, like, I don't know, like, into a street. Or just like, into yeah, like, have a bunch of people, mm-hmm, in a park. And just, like, see, yeah, how fast the cops show up. Because, you know, it turns, yeah, out, like, yeah, yeah.
First,
like,
time I was at any kind of protest, cops immediately wanted to take anything I was holding. You're not allowed to. It's, yeah, like the first thing. If you have anything in your hands, that's, mm-hmm, that is a problem.
Yeah, it's like the First Amendment is just, it's super, completely superseded by traffic laws, like laws about like sidewalk maintenance. Like, not, it's all fake. Like, none of it.
Yeah.
Like, you're not allowed to. And this I think is partially why, this is kind of a topic, but this is partially, I think, why there's so much focus on the right about the First Amendment, because they want to draw attention away from the fact that, like, the actual thing that's fake about it is that you can't gather people and meet anywhere, and they want to draw it into these, like, inane, like, this professor, like, said the N-word a bunch of times in class,
yes,
and isn't, yeah, it bad that people,
right,
are mad at them? But I think also,
yeah,
tying this sort of back to Occupy, you know, okay, so Occupy functions right insofar as there is a physical location where people can go and physically interact with each other. And that's a problem, because at some point the police are just like, no. And,
yeah,
they start clearing the encampments. And I think this is the other thing with Occupy, is that outside of like parts of Oakland, and that's a whole other thing that, yeah, but it's incredible, like studiously nonviolent in a way that like nothing I've ever seen before or since is.
Yeah. So there's a lot there. I want to talk about it because there's a lot. But yeah. So I think the militarization of the police thesis is incomplete if you don't also talk about the policification of the military, right? Mm-hmm. So like part of what happens with the great expansion of the carceral state, part of that is also a response to the Vietnam War. Yep. And mass resistance within, you know, the troops. There are like in the last 2 years when ground troops are there in Vietnam, there's like 1,400 fragging incidents where privates and recruits killed their officers. The U.S. Army during Vietnam was on the brink of collapse in the way that like the Russian army was looking in 1917.
Yeah,
right?
It was so, like the numbers. I think saw a number at one point. There was like 40% of the army by the end of Vietnam was either on strike or just like not following orders.
Yeah, no, it was complete. There was the reason that Nixon pursues Vietnamization, which is when they just start doing air campaigns, bombing and napalm, is because they couldn't rely on ground troops anymore. They were useless. They were all high. You know, the talk about, you know, there's a lot of talk about like heroin, but like that was actually kind of a form of resistance within the lines in a complicated way. Whatever. Okay, that's all very. So the military realizes that it can't function as a mass military in the model that nation states have done since the Napoleonic Wars, right? Which is like the mass, you know, the mass recruitment of the citizen soldier. That's sort of how war is fought between, you know, 1810 and 1970. And then it becomes clear that that's not going to work anymore because the aims of the countries and the power of nationalism have become too abstracted. Fascism has done too much damage to that image. There's just like, it doesn't really work anymore. So the military turns into a sort of, what it always was also, which is like a colonial mm-hmm. policing force. And so the police and the military drift towards one another in form and function. Okay. So in Occupy, one of the micro histories that I think gets forgotten is that like, I mean, because it took a week and like who remembers this week except for like weirdos like me who were there, is that like there was no one at Zuccotti in the first week. And one of the big things that happened was these you know, young white girls got caught in a police net and pepper sprayed. And there was this video that went around of them getting pepper sprayed and screaming. Mm-hmm. This woman on her knees, you know, screaming with tears and pepper spray going down her face. And that really outraged people because, you know, they were, you know, it was police repression and police violence. So in terms of the question of nonviolence, yes, there was a lot of nonviolence. It was a constant fight that took until the George Floyd uprising for the right for our side to win, frankly. But during Occupy, there was, you know, there was a lot of nonviolence nonsense. And I think like, but another thing that happened though was that like, you know, like I said, people were marching every day. So even in New York, where I think the political height was kind of achieved October 1st when we took the Brooklyn Bridge, I think New York never really like had a big moment again. Like it was largely sort of like smaller things after that. But there was a mass arrest on the Brooklyn Bridge. So we marched over the Brooklyn Bridge. The Brooklyn Bridge got shut down. They arrested 700 of us. It was the first big infrastructure shutdown that happened in the U.S. since the L.A. riots. It was a big deal at the time. Now it happens all the time.
Can I put a note out, though, specifically for the Brooklyn Bridge? If you're, because people, I've seen every single time there's one of these movements, people try to take the Brooklyn Bridge and they all get arrested. And it's like, can y'all, like, please, I am begging you, if you're going to try to take a bridge, make sure you have a way out. Like, you have to hold one of the sides. Otherwise, all of you are going to get arrested.
Exactly.
You got to have a way out.
A bridge is designed to not have a way out. That's how bridges work. Yeah, exactly.
please don't all get arrested. It's in fact bad and... Yeah, sorry.
Exactly. Yeah. No.
I have seen a few people successfully take bridges a few times, but that's because there was like three cop cars and like 15,000 people.
Yeah,
exactly.
If you have like a block with 200 kids, you're not going to be able to hold the bridge.
Yeah.
It Could Happen Here is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more podcasts from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find sources for It Could Happen Here updated monthly at coolzonemedia.com/sources. Thanks for listening.